Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I have another wonderful guest on the podcast, and I'm so excited that we're going to have a conversation about things that I know many of you think about often and don't necessarily know how to discuss. And I have Dr. Nan Wise on the podcast today, and she is the author of a phenomenal book that I'm going to recommend all of you go out and get. And it's Why Good Sex Matters: Understanding the Neuroscience of Pleasure for a Smarter, Happier, and More Purpose-Filled Life. So Dr. Nan, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Mona. So just to give you a little bit of background about how I came to this work.
I'd love that.
Is I come from a long line of people with some anxiety wiring. Some big time anxiety wiring. So I had my first really massive panic attack in my early 20s. And I was really trying to figure out how to navigate this nervous system, because I knew that I wanted to learn how to be happier. I wanted to learn how to enjoy my life in spite of the anxiety. So I went on a journey, which is both personal and professional, for quite a few decades, becoming a clinical social worker, becoming a sex therapist. And then I went back to graduate school at the age of 50 to study neuroscience, because I was always passionate about how the brain mind worked.
Yeah.
So that's really been my journey, finding tools to help me and to help my clients be able to enjoy being in their bodies and connecting with other people and having fun and having happy relationships and happy lives.
I love it. And if you had that special potion and we could share it with all of the listeners, oh my gosh, what a joyous, happy life we would all live. So we're only going to talk for about an hour, but I hope that a lot of what we're going to talk about is really going to be helpful and is going to help people think about how they're living their life now and how they want to change things for the better. So I'd love to start out a little bit with some of the effective habits that you have shared with your clients and shared with folks that you work with that can help them create the kind of positive life we're talking about.
That's a great question. And it's, if we had a magic potion, Mona, it would be the ability to tolerate our own feelings and to tolerate our partner's feelings, and to realize that our emotions have information for us if we listen into the feelings.
Yes.
And what we also can learn to do is, in spite of our challenges, in spite of anxiety, in spite of depression or any kind of challenges that we have, it's not an either or universe. We can learn to be happy even with our challenges by, the number one thing is learning how to radically accept where we are and how we are.
Gosh, I hear you. And that's been a major part of my healing journey, because in my 30-year marriage, I didn't understand our differences. I didn't understand myself. And I know that I could not regulate my emotions oftentimes. And I know I hear that from a lot of the listeners who join me in my support groups. So what are the kind of core differences that kind of create defensiveness or anger, or, you know, those emotions we call negative, which aren't necessarily negative? What are some of the,
Well, let me start with explaining about the core emotions
Wonderful.
and why understanding our own wiring in that regard and working with our partner's wiring, that's the most important thing, that skill. So nature has wired us right out of the box when we're born with seven basic emotional instincts that we share with all other mammals and many other animals. And this has been a rather recent discovery in the past 20, 25 years that we do have these circuits that are what we call the embodied emotions. And they come in different flavors. So first and foremost, the system that works with all of the systems is called the seeking system. And what that system does, and that's powered by dopamine, it gets us into the world to meet our needs. So we have to meet our needs for food, safety, homeostasis, connection with other people, all of the things that we need to survive and thrive comes from this drive or desire to go out into the world and meet those needs. So that's the seeking system. And the seeking system works with all the other systems. So of the other systems, there's basically two categories. The ones that feel good, which actually move us into like, we will approach things that stimulate those feelings. Number one is the care system. And the care system is powered by our own internal opioids and oxytocin primarily. And that is the feelings that we get when we connect with people, with you know, the people in our lives that give us that sense of well-being. Now, if that circuitry is not working well, meaning we might have problems with it, it may hamper our ability to connect with people. It might actually drive us into things that, if the opioid systems don't work, sometimes into addictive kind of behaviors. But the care system is really the physiology of love.
Love it.
So we have care, and then another positive system that's underdeveloped in most adults is the play system. So the play system is the system that's wired into all young mammals. How do they learn about the world? They go out and play. So they learn how to compete, how to cooperate, how to explore. And actually, it's the play system that gives us a lot of our feelings of social joy. A lot of us, because of anxiety or imbalances in the defensive systems, we end up feeling a lack of access to the play system. So for the positive systems that feel good, and how do we know it feels good? When they stimulate these circuits, how did they learn about this? They mapped them out in animals. The animals will actually work to get stimulation to the pleasurable systems, and they'll work to turn off stimulation to the aversive systems that we'll talk about the defenses in a minute. And when they also have operated on human beings because of things like seizures, epilepsy, and they've accidentally stimulated those systems, the human beings express having those feelings as well. So those circuits are real. So we have the care system, we have the play system, and last but not least, the lust system. And the lust system wires us to at times have that urge to merge. So those are what we call the affiliative systems that feel good, and you know, those are the that cause us to kind of approach. Whereas the defensive systems, fear, which is self-explanatory, why we need to be afraid of things that are dangerous for us. And by the way, this is wired into us so that you don't have to teach a baby to fear things that are painful or to fear heights. These are wired in the fear system. The other defenses include rage. And the rage system is stimulated when we are frustrated to meet, when we can't meet our needs, or when somebody or something steps on our toes or threatens our resources. It makes sense that we need to have, you know, appropriate access to those emotions.
Sure.
So that we can listen into it, we make decisions, you know, based on that information. Unfortunately, some people are wired in a way they're hot-tempered a lot, and you can see that happening with some people where that system is stays on and is very has a hair trigger.
Yes.
And last but not least, the other defensive system, which works as the kind of the balancing or the dark side of the care system, is something called panic. They call it panic, grief, and sadness. Sometimes they'll just say panic or sadness. But that's the system that gets triggered when we feel a loss to or threat to our relationships. And when you think about it, nature needed to wire us that, because as for example, a small animal, baby animal taken away from or separated from the parent is going to be a lunch or meal for another animal. So
true.
That separation distress is a survival mechanism.
Sure.
So when we feel loss, when we feel grief, when we lose a relationship or loved one, that is the system that gets triggered. Some people are very panicky about their relationships. People who have anxious attachments, that system is on a lot. And also, if that system is malfunctioning in a way, it can be correlated with people experiencing depression.
Yeah.
So when we say core differences, we're wired differently. So if, for example, I have a lot of defensive kind of activations, and I'm with a partner who has maybe similar ones, we got two hot-tempered people together, we're going to have a problem. The other thing is when people are very different in the basement of the brains, so that they have trouble understanding each other. So people who don't have as much defensive systems may not really understand a partner who does.
Yes.
So that's the core differences. And then that's sort of the basement of them, but that translates into more, shall we say, higher level differences. So, for example, some people need a lot of predictability. They need and want predictability, where their partner might not. Their partner might want to be spontaneous. That would be an important core difference.
Absolutely.
Another big core difference, I see this all the time in my couples counseling, is somebody who feels like togetherness comes first. So they want their partner to plan with them things and not make plans on their own. And they think that that's like the right thing. That's what relationships, if you're in a relationship, you consult your partner before you make any plans that might affect them. And some people are more about separateness first.
Right.
So it's not that it's worse or better. They're just wired where they like to be more separate. They might have a tendency to make plans without their partner, expecting their partner to be okay about it. If they're with a partner who also was wired that way and likes separateness first, you know, they're going to not have a problem. But if one feels that separateness should come first and the other feels togetherness should come first, you got some conflicts.
Absolutely. And I hear that all the time in the support groups that I facilitate.
Right.
Yeah.
Another big difference is how people react to being angry. Some people take a long time. They have a long, long, their response to conflict is they have a long fuse. Some people are more, they're more quick to conflict and they may get over it quickly. So that's another area, how people handle those kinds of emotions that comes up with people. Another big area is whether we plan for the future or we live for the now. You know, so these kinds of, when I'm working with couples, I really like to help them understand their own wiring and each other's wiring so they can better understand and better listen and build bridges between the differences. So those are some of the examples.
I think those are going to be so helpful to everybody that's listening. And I want to go back a little bit to kind of the seeking system, because, you know, I hear this often from couples and from individuals in neurodiverse relationships, that usually one of them has a very strong seeking system. I was that person in my marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, I was always searching for that next dopamine hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when your partner is somebody that likes routine and predictability and maybe more planning, or, you know, having more control over their schedule, that can become a major conflict. And to one partner, it may look like the other partner is not committed to the relationship, does not value them, does not love them. And those are all stories we tell ourselves. So because that is a common theme that I see, is there something in particular that you do to work with your clients to help them understand that they're both right and their needs are all justified?
Well, that's a very important point, Mona, because one of the things most people argue about matters of opinion, mm-hmm. not actually things that are right and wrong. And what I find is, and the reason why I wrote Why Good Sex Matters, is helping people understand how the brain mind works
mm-hmm.
can help them work better when they understand their own wiring. So let's say, you know, you're the one who's high in seeking and your partner not so much. Having that awareness, having that information, being able to navigate that together, being able to talk about it, understand it, helps normalize it so that you're not battling over something. You are realizing that there are some differences, that if you climb into each other's experiences a little bit more deeply and get the understandable part, the number mm-hmm. one thing, the number one couple skill. And when I work with people, I use things that have been shown by research to be effective. And I happen to love, there is this relationship center in actually Ohio. Mm-hmm. And the guy, Brent Atkinson, wrote a textbook for couples therapists. And he also wrote a workbook for people, for couples. And then we can include that in references, you know, in resources for your listeners if they're interested in getting that workbook.
Sure.
The number one skill for people who do effective partnership is they maintain a non-judgmental attitude.
Yes.
Absolutely. Now, we judge. That's what human beings do. But when right. we're aware of that it's simply a matter of opinion, and if we loosen and soften our judgments and we get the understandable part that it looks different to our partner, and they're, the way they see the world, the way they see this is just as valid as the way that we see it, then you're not fighting or having power struggles so much. You're able to then climb more into each other's experiences, get the understandable part, learn the tools about how to advocate for what you need. One of the big problems in relationship, believe it or not, isn't the offenses. People think, like, you know, like lying, cheating, all of that. That, yeah, that's bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there are habits that people do on a regular basis that can be just as deleterious over the long run as those more obvious relationship offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big ones, believe it or not, Mona, is not learning how to take effective stands for what you need and want with your in your relationship.
Oh, I absolutely understand that. And I think, Dr. Nan, a lot of folks do not know how to set boundaries. They think that that is putting up a wall. They don't know what their needs are. So how can they share them with their partner?
Right.
Right? Yeah.
And they expect the partner. One of the biggest complaints that people have is, well, my partner should know this, or my partner should I shouldn't have to ask for this. Not only, not only do we need to ask for what we need and want, we need to be able to do it like calm, broken records. So talk about diversity. In my own household, my wiring is I'm like a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit, on the OCD side. You don't go to do PhDs in neuroscience without being a little bit OCD.
At 50, right? Yeah.
Right, at 50. Whereas my husband is way more on the ADHD kind of thing. So his perspectives, what he sees and how he looks at the world, is much more, I would say, lateral. Like he looks across things and I'm more like linear. I look down very strategically at stuff. And because he sees the world very differently than I do, I need to not just assume that he should know after 43 years of relationship and marriage and 50 years of relationship, he should know this or he should see this. It's learning how to be a calm, broken record about what you want and what you need, as long as it's obviously not a dire emergency kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, like learning how to be calm. And the more calm that we are with our partners when we take stands, we can be more effective. The information gets in. And after a while, if we're calm and we're like a calm, broken record, it gets in. It really does. Over time, it'll get in. So a lot of these skills that we need to learn in relationship, especially if we have differences in how we're wired, whether it's in the basement of the brain or whether somebody is, you know, more neurotypical and somebody else is more neurodiverse, that if we practice the skills and we understand that, for example, by being a calm, you know, taking stands is important, being able to explain what we want, what we need, and also learning when a partner's not working with us, how to take effective stands to get them to work with us. And if they're not working with us in that moment, or if things don't go so well, not make it a federal case, not make up a story about what the partner is not good or the partner is not responsive or the partner is being, you know, some kind of negative way. To recognize how to, the bottom line is how to regulate ourselves so that we can get back into balance and then we can reapproach the partner and say, hey, that didn't go so good. Can we try it again? Can and you that, work with me? Yeah.
And that is one of the most difficult things that I hear couples talk about. And I know it was horribly difficult in my marriage. And it was because we were wired so differently and needed different things when our nervous systems were dysregulated. So you have a term that you use called elongating exhalation that allows people to shift from that fight and flight mode to a more relaxed nervous system. Can you talk a little bit about maybe what people can do to get to that place?
Yeah. This is a very important tool. And I think when we need to be able to be effective, whether it's with ourselves or partners, what we need to be able to do is to shift out of the flight or fight mode where most of us live most of the time. That's a whole longer conversation about how we're living that's not working for us, that's causing this tsunami of mental health challenges that we're seeing. But so the simple tool, like you don't have to spend hours meditating. You don't have to go to yoga classes and learn a lot of fancy breath tools. If you simply practice when you breathe, when you take a long, smooth inhale through your nostrils and then make the exhalation just a little bit longer than the inhale. So if you can actually, if it's comfortable breathing in through the nostrils and also exhaling through the nostrils, extending the exhalation just a little bit longer than the inhale What that does is it shifts us out of that flight or fight. And for some people, it's freeze. When people get overwhelmed, some people don't fight or flight, they freeze and they dissociate. They get frozen. That's a very common response with stress for people. If you can practice that on a regular basis, that will help rebalance those core emotions out of the defenses into where we get much more in touch with not only physical well-being, because that helps take the strain off of the bodies, why so many people have hypertension and heart diseases that we are living in that flight or fight or freeze. And we can't really do relationship and connection very well from that space, whether it's trying to connect with ourselves or somebody else. So the first thing I teach my clients when we work together is to get more in touch with their bodies, because a lot of times, and I was just talking about this yesterday with people who are doing a documentary on well-being, is that if we can train ourselves anytime we're noticing that we have tension in the body or sort of tightness or worrisome thoughts, let that become the prompt or the cue to take that long, smooth inhale and the longer, smooth exhalation. So essentially, what we're training ourselves to do is to shift out of flight or fight or freeze into the restorative state, which is so much better for our bodies. It's so much better for our well-being and so much better for the co-regulation that we want to do with partners. We want to be able to calm our nervous systems and stay calm when we're dealing with our partners. And that can be contagious in a good way. Just like the flight or fight, when people get really upset, that's contagious. We can learn to calm ourselves. And when we stay calm, we can be connected, whether it's with our partners, our children, or people in our lives. That's the most important thing, is being able to regulate our own emotions and to be able to stay calm and connect with people around us.
I think it, thank you so much for that. I think if everybody that's listening was able to do the elongated exhalation on a regular basis, again, I think their relationships will begin to improve, exponentially. Now, here's the challenge, Dr. Nan. A lot of folks that are listening may themselves have alexithymia, or their partner might have alexithymia, or they may have challenges with, what they're feeling in their body, like interoception. And I think you kind of introduced me to the word anhedonia. Is that, yeah. So can we speak to that? Because I know for those that are not totally able to tap into their emotions, feelings, or what's going on in their bodies, this may feel overwhelming and very difficult.
Well, that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. The ability to tune into the body channel is something that people can learn. It may be harder for them to affix a feeling label to it, but you can get people to tune into the body channel. What does that mean? You're sitting on the chair, you feel your tush on the chair, you feel yourself breathing. The more that people pay attention to the bodies, and by the way, this is not just a factor for people with alexithymia. The vast majority of people that I work with are heads on sticks. They're not aware of what's going on in their bodies. If you ask them, what's happening in your body? Well, I don't know. And they look at me like I'm crazy. So what's really very simple in a way is that we make emotions way more complicated than they really are. So the embodied emotions, everybody feels them. People feel in situations where they're, unless there's something literally wrong with their brains, and that's not alexithymia in the sense I'm talking about when they have brain damage. People will feel fear when they're threatened. They'll feel rage when they're backed into a corner or have resources taken away from them. They feel these embodied emotions if they are actually able to pay attention to the sensations in the body. Because these core emotions are sensations in the body. What I mean by emotions, we make them complicated. So when we talk about emotions in the more cognitively infused way, so like the basic feeling of emotion, for example, is, let's say, rage, right? Mm-hmm. You feel it in your body, your face flushes, mm-hmm. your heart pounds, right?
Yes.
But then you have people talking about things like disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
So disrespected is a very cognitive idea. It's what we do with our higher minds to activations from the core emotions that infuse them with these concepts like, you know, I feel disrespected.
Yeah. And I hear that often.
Right. So that's really the more cognitively infused. When you, even in psychology, in my field, there's such debates about whether there are core emotions, what are the core emotions. And you know, cognitive psychology is all about these higher order feelings and emotions that are much more infused. And when we take it down to make it more simple and basic, mm-hmm. there's information in our bodies that we can pay attention to when we get into the body channel. And people can learn more and more about how to focus on and pay attention to what's happening in their bodies.
And I think that is so important. And I hear this often from couples who are challenged when it comes to physical and sexual intimacy, neurodiverse couples. Mm-hmm. And one partner, and it can be, you know, the man, the woman, the person who's non-binary, it's not about gender, may not even know what brings them pleasure. You know, mm-hmm. they're so disconnected from that aspect of their body. And so I always recommend, you know, a sex therapist or a sex educator if they're interested. And I have several who've been on the podcast who have expertise in working with neurodiverse couples. And I'm going to add you to my list.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there something that you offer or suggest to those couples that are having this disconnect when it comes to physical or sexual intimacy?
Well, I think it boils down to feeling safe.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're having disconnects with partners, a lot of times is that we aren't feeling safe, and we're not feeling safe because we're not understanding each other. We're not feeling the ability to tap into that sense of care, mm-hmm. play. You know, we get shut down even then in the less department. People who are having sexual issues, and I write about this in my book, it's the window into, it's like the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. It's the window into something is out of sorts with the core emotions, and often it has to do with they're not feeling safe and relaxed enough to be able to be in touch with their bodies and connected with the partner. And they don't have access then to the care play and even the seeking system, getting curious about how they can connect and what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And that becomes a very difficult conversation to start because, you know, if you don't know kind of the root cause of this. And so I hope the listeners are really hearing if they don't feel safe, they don't feel connected to themselves or their partner, to be able to explore that together so you can get to the root of what needs to change, whether it's individually or together or probably both, so that you can have a satisfying and healthy physical and sexual relationship, right?
Right. And like we were talking about, excuse me, my dog is barking. I don't know how much you're hearing. If she continues, I'll go pick her up.
She wants to get in on the conversation.
Yeah. She hears somebody downstairs. It goes back to the core differences.
Sure.
When people experience conflict with each other that keeps happening, mm-hmm. that eradicates and may make it very difficult for them to feel safe with the partner.
Absolutely.
So a lot of that is, I think, funded by the core differences when people don't understand the differences between them and their partners and how they think, how they're wired. They tend to end up with conflict, and with and through the conflict, they end up feeling defended and afraid rather than relaxed and present.
Absolutely. And I think, one of the core things that we do not learn is how to understand where things have disconnected or are disconnecting. Because oftentimes we get into relationships with people, we don't understand our own neurotype, we don't understand their neurotype, and there's this repeated disconnection on all these levels, right? So, what do you, or what are some of the things that you share with couples when they're in kind of these different kind of relationships? Because, if I was talking to my friends about what was going on in my marriage, they didn't necessarily understand it. And so I felt kind of like an outsider. And that's why I love doing the support groups, because people find people who are literally experiencing the same thing they are. So how do you help with that disconnect that just keeps happening over and over and over again?
So the challenge for people who are having that repeated disconnect is to learn how to, number one, calm their own nervous system so that they can feel connected with themselves. And then to get curious about the differences with the partner. One of the tools that I use, believe it or not, with couples, a lot of couples, is teaching them how to sit next to each other and breathe at the same time. So, like, kind of doing the entrainment of the nervous system. So, this I actually learned many years ago when I was studying yoga and tantra, is that you can create, when you're not feeling the cognitive connection or the emotional connection with a partner, you can reset your own nervous system and you can actually entrain your nervous systems by breathing together.
I love that. I love
you don't
that.
even have to do it with your partner. So let's say your partner is kind of not on the same page with you about something, and maybe they're not available to sit there and breathe together with you. You sit next to the person and you just match their breath. Or you lie down, if you're in bed with the partner, you sync your breath with their breath. And what we know is that there is this natural wired incapacity for mammals to entrain. So, for example, my barking dog, who's no longer barking, when you put a pet on your lap or you sit next to your pet, did you know that there is a tendency for there to be an entrainment in the heart rates?
Oh yeah, I've heard that.
Right. So, and then there is so they're not, their hearts are beating faster than ours because that's how dogs are, but the rhythms start to sync. And there's a synchrony that happens when we're paying good attention to each other as human beings. Eye contact for people who can do that, where it's comfortable, that actually can sync the emotional brain. When people, or if you're not big on eye contact, listening to a partner's voice. There's a whole branch of the vagus nerve, which can downregulate. The reason why we extend the exhalation is it engages the vagus brake, which slows the heart down and tells your body, hey, you're safe. We can digest our food. We can heal our bodies. It's a restorative system. That when we can listen to our partner's voice or we speak to a partner in a calm way, that can also create entrainment. So there's a lot of ways, just the sound of the voice, it doesn't even have to be what the person is saying, can engage the social vagus in a way that helps downregulate the defensive systems and promotes connection. So when we have differences in terms of how we're wired, we still have the ability to use our wired in capacity for entrainment. that is it's in all organisms. It's not just, it's not like people don't have that. That ability is there.
I love that, and I've heard so much about heart coherence. And yeah, and how in a love relationship we can have heart coherence when we don't understand each other or we're dysregulated. And when we can have that coherence, I guess it's kind of like entrainment, we can relax our nervous system. Is that, do I have that correct or?
Exactly. And another
Okay.
skill, another tool that helps promote that is giving the partner the benefit of the doubt.
And not
Rather than
assuming.
not assuming. So one of the things when we talk neurodiversity, because people are looking at things very differently, it's an exaggeration of what goes on every day with neurotypical couples. So we make a lot of assumptions that we think that our partner, when they say something, we think we know what they mean. We assume they know what we mean. And in a lot of ways, we're speaking very different languages. And that's certainly accentuated when you have people who are diverse within a
I agree.
relationship.
Absolutely.
So, one of the things that I think is so wonderful, the tool that has helped my husband and I more than anything else, is we learned many years ago to do deep listening, really deep listening, where we give each other sessions. And what that means is it's a version of active listening. So active listening is one person is talking, the other person is actively listening. What does that mean? All the listener does, their job is simply to say back to the person who's speaking, what I hear you saying is that correct? Is there more? There's no interpretations. There's no listening to fix, listening to make a partner wrong, listening to make a point. It's simply what I call like Vegas. What goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas.
I love that.
And my favorite story about this is a bunch of years back. So we're both, my husband's 67, I'm 66. We've been together since we're 17. It's a long, long journey.
Wow.
All
Yeah, I
right.
love it.
One day, maybe 20, 25 years ago, probably more like 30 years ago. Boy, we're getting there. My husband came home and he looked really upset. And we had that tool. So I said to him, "You don't look so good. Do you want to take a session?" What that meant was I was agreeing to hold the space kind of off the record. So I couldn't use what he said during that session against him at any point. I just was offering to listen to him. And he said, yes, we agreed. We both made the agreement that we were going to do a formal listening session. I was going to listen and he was going to be the speaker. And what he said was, I can't stand coming home to you. Now, I will tell you, Mona, if that happened, if he said that to me and it wasn't a formal session, that would not have gone well.
Sure. And I will tell you, Dr. Nan, my ex-husband said the same thing to me, and we didn't have this tool. So you can imagine the rage and the emotions that
Oh,
Mona felt.
I'm sure, and even having that tool, there are times that things don't go so well. So skilled partners learn that they don't make a federal case out of when things don't go so well. They don't make up a story about their partners and that they go, okay, that didn't go so well. Are you in a space where we can try that again? So when John came home, my husband came home and we had a formal session. He told me that. All I said to him, so what I hear you saying is that you can't stand coming home to me. Is there more? And boy, oh boy, oh boy, was there more. And so some of it, Mona, had to do with me, which was good information. A lot of it had to do with what he was struggling with that made him feel very shamed and very, very pained about facing me. And my husband and I both look at that day as the beginning of a really grown-up marriage. And
Wow,
it
thank you so much for sharing that. That is so, so, so helpful. So helpful. The fact that you agree that you both need a listening session, number one, that you both agree that this is not to be used against the other, because I tell you, Dr. Nan, I was guilty of that repeatedly, using
We all
stuff,
have done that. Yeah, we
right?
all have done that. Sure.
It was kind of my modus operandi often. Remember when you said, remember when you did? Yeah. So what when he started sharing, and you don't have to go any deeper than this, but if you're willing, when he started sharing all these things that he did not like about you, were you able to keep the listening session going?
Absolutely, because I made that
Wow.
commitment to not take it personally in that moment, to listen in, hold that space for him. And what he was able to do was he was able to get to the stuff that was projection. A lot of what happens in couples is we project onto each other. That's
Sure.
kind of so what he got to was how he was feeling such deep shame about what he feels, letting himself down about something, where he was in his career, letting me down, being ashamed and embarrassed. For men in particular, a lot of men have a lot of shame around money and work.
Yes.
So, like, and it's not just men, but, the whole idea about men having to provide and him feeling that he let himself down. And then he was withholding certain things, not telling me certain things because he was afraid of my reaction. Because sometimes I was reactive with him. So it was really good that we had this tool. So when either one of us would have something, that we were upset about, whether it's about our relationship or things that affected us in other ways. And, we would come and ask each other for sessions. But what really is important for people who have very big core differences, which is a lot of people, whether it's in terms of neurodiversity, is having a regular practice, Mona,
Yes.
where you're not waiting until the shit's hitting the fan, where you're connecting. So, and it's not always about your relationship in terms of issues between you. It can be holding space for the partner to climb into their experience. Like, it's one of the things that I encourage people who don't know what to talk about when they take sessions, because a lot of times people, I don't know what I would say. You could just start with what was the high point of my day? What was the low point of my day? Because what we want to do is over, not just in terms of creating a relationship, we want to continue relating to each other and climbing into each other's experiences so we really can feel the connection and the empathy. We can learn to really understand more and more how our partners are seeing and experiencing us, themselves in the world.
Amen. Amen and hallelujah to everything you just said. Because we don't learn these skills, Dr. Nan, in our, childhood, because usually there's, dysfunction with our parents or our caregivers, and we don't learn it in school, and then we're expected to succeed in an intimate relationship with a total stranger who comes from another, dysfunctional family or their own family of origin. And we really need, like, the first 5 years of a relationship. We need somebody, a mentor, a coach, a therapist, a counselor, an educator who we can go to on a regular basis. And it should be free. That's just my own feeling. It
Yes.
should be
Yes.
free and accessible to everybody, because we'd be better partners, we'd be better ourselves, we'd be better parents, we'd be better siblings, all children, everything, adult children. And, because we don't have access to this, or it's very expensive to get it on a regular basis, there are so many people that are suffering that still love each other, that love their family members, that love their children, that love their spouses, and they're just creating so much intentional hurt and pain.
And when you think about it, the idea of the nuclear family is a relatively new thing in terms of human history.
Yeah.
And to think that a couple should be able to basically meet all of each other's needs and be able to navigate life with whether they have kids or not, It used to be the function that you're talking about, the coach, the mentor was like an elder of the tribe, an older,
Absolutely.
an aunt, a cousin, an older sibling, somebody, or you know, a somebody in
Grandparent.
the com yeah, somebody in the
Yeah.
community, even if it
Yeah.
was clergy, that could hold space for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't really have that. And I was thinking about, I just turned 60 this year, and I remember how important it was for me to spend time with my grandparents. And I had great aunts and uncles and an aunt and uncle who lived really close. And pretty much every week or every other week, we would spend time together. And I can remember literally sitting around the kitchen table with these other women who were my elders and listening to them share stories about really intimate details of their lives, you know, whether it was sex, which they talked about often, or it was their relationships at work or with their parents or whatever. And it was such a time of joy because I was learning about relationships from people that I loved and that I could see that none of them were perfect, you know? They were all human and they laughed about their mistakes and they cried. And my daughter didn't really have that because all her grandparents died when she was young. So I tried to create that with my friends, but so many of us do not have that. I know Michelle Obama calls it the kitchen table friends.
Yep.
And right, and we
Yep.
need it. We need
Yep.
it. So yeah.
And we need to get off our devices and really
Ugh.
pay good attention to each other. I mean, it's
I
just,
agree.
it's this is the this is a real this is a tsunami of mental health challenges as a result of people being disconnected from
Yes.
themselves and each other and hijacked the seeking system hijacked. So, you know, all of this is really kind of, you know, learning how to have these tools over the lifespan. Because when you have a relationship at first, you know, when you're younger people, you're having one kind of marriage. You know, we talk about a lot of different kinds of marriages. You know,
Yeah.
if you're in the child, you know, rearing years, that's one kind of relationship. You know, when there are two times in the life cycle of relationship that relationships are higher at risk for all sorts of problems. One is when the when they're having children, when you're having children and you're becoming a family, the other is when the kids leave.
Absolutely.
And when the kids leave, when people have been busy focusing on kids and other things and not building their relationship and working, relating, you need to grow. We all grow, and we need to grow our relationships. One size is not going to fit over the course of your lifespan.
Nope.
And I'm a big proponent of sustainable relationships. I don't say there are times people should leave relationships. I'm not shaming people for leaving relationships. I'm just saying if we had more tools, I think that we'd be able to sustain the relationships that we have. Because a lot of times people leave one relationship and they go create another mess in another relationship if they haven't grown.
Yes, I
Yeah.
agree. I agree. And that's why I think if you do leave a relationship, taking time to heal. And for me, you know, that was therapy. That was, you know, traveling to see family and friends. That was taking time alone to meditate, to walk, to work out, to do all these things, and to read. And, you know, if you don't take time to heal, not that any of us are going to be fully healed when we move from one relationship to the other, but if we don't learn new skills and we don't change the patterns that, you know, maybe we didn't recognize in our past relationship, we are going to repeat those same patterns.
Exactly. You know what I tell people when they're trying to figure out do they stay or go? Like, I get that a lot with, I
Okay.
don't know if I want to work on this relationship. I don't know if I want to stay in the relationship. I say to them, the work's the same. And the reason why the work is the same, relationships break down because they're actually working to point out to us how we need to grow as human beings.
I agree.
And if we do that growth, we might decide to let go of that relationship. You know, we may that may not be lasting love, but if we do the work in becoming more fully developed and whole as people, we might be able to stay and have another the chapter of the relationship. We may go on to have, you know, a wonderful next level, you know, leg of the journey, or we might be able to go and create a relationship from a space of being more fully developed as a person and as a partner.
I 100% agree. And I know there are a lot of folks out there that listen to the podcast that are asking that question, should I stay or should I go? And I hope that all the things we've talked about today will help you think about what is it that I need to do individually, not what my partner needs to change, but what I need to do, and then what I need to talk to my partner about us doing together. Because it's never just one person, you know, it just isn't. And even if we get our partners to change, they may change for a short period of time, but we need to look in the mirror too. And I love all the things that you've shared today, the tools and, you know, going in depth into the different systems and how, you know, we may not understand why our body's doing the things that it's doing and how we can, you know, do the elongated exhalation individually and together. And, you know, having those listening sessions, I think are going to change people's lives. But I also know there are folks that are going to say, my partner would never do that. And mm-hmm. So I think that's data. For me, that mm-hmm. was data. When my ex-husband said, I am not doing any more work, I have no more bandwidth for being in this relationship with you, I had to hear him.
Yeah.
And it's not easy, but, you know, thinking that it will change, even when your partner is telling you their truth, you may be engaging in something that is going to cause you tremendous suffering over the long term. So, again, this has been a phenomenal conversation. Is there anything else that you'd like to share kind of as your parting words before you tell people how they can reach you?
Well, I think if you realize at the end of the day that what's affecting us as individuals is not just about us, it's about how there's a lot of challenges. People are so stressed out. People don't have a lot of tools, that if you give yourself and your partner the benefit of the doubt, you learn how to reset your nervous system simply by just giving yourself permission to be, and to also take 100% responsibility for what's your part of what's showing up in this space. Both couples have to take 100, both people in a couple, 100% responsibility for what they're creating in this space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we don't. We often don't. Yeah.
We fixate a lot of times on trying to fix the partner
right.
when we're not looking at taking an honest inventory of our own, what our expectations are and how we're creating a lot of the relationship offenses by not practicing good skills.
I agree 100%. So for folks that want to get your book, it's available on Amazon and probably where a lot of, you know, where they shop for books these days, although there aren't a lot of bookstores out there anymore. But it's Why Good Sex Matters: Understanding the Neuroscience of Pleasure for a Smarter, Happier, and More Purpose-Filled Life.
Right.
And where is it that people can find you if they're interested? I always ask, do you do coaching too, or just?
I call it therapeutic coaching. Mm-hmm. And it's short-term interventions. And any of your listeners who want to reach out to me, if they go to my website, www.askdrnan, and the doctor is spelled out with all the letters, drnan.com, they can sign up for a free consult with me. And I can jump on the phone or do a Zoom with them and answer their questions and give them some suggestions or, you know, work out some kind of coaching for them. And most of the people that I work with, my approach is short term, helping people mm-hmm. cook up plans and learning tools and skills. So I usually work out a pretty good plan with people from anywhere from like 6 to 8 sessions.
I love it.
Sometimes 4 to 6. It depends. And then we give them tools and then they get access to me virtually through texting or email for life, that I can help them develop new skills, new emotional habits.
Oh my gosh. You don't be surprised if you get bombarded, Dr. Nan.
I would love that, Mona. Thank you.
Because I will tell you, the listenership has gone up tremendously. I'm almost at 250,000 downloads. I have people from 74 countries listening, and
Wow.
what I hear often, and that's why I always ask if my guests do coaching, is what I hear often is, I'm in Taiwan, I'm in, Australia, I am in, Singapore, do you know anybody that does this work over here? And I always refer them to the coaches, but a lot of the coaches are inundated and they have wait lists. So I'm
I
so
don't
glad.
have a wait list. I work with people all over the country and the world. Part of why I don't have a wait list is I get people in and out. You know what I mean?
Yes,
So
I
that
love that.
I'm not staying, not that I won't work with people as long as they need me, but it's a very focused kind of skills and tools and understanding kind of thing that help people. And then they're working with me beyond the sessions, and then I'm helping people navigate challenges and develop new emotional tools. So I was working virtually before the epidemic, before COVID. So I work with people all over.
That's wonderful. Well, I
Okay.
hope that lots of people reach out, and I can't thank you enough for sharing your expertise and your time with the listeners. And it was such a pleasure talking to you and such a pleasure meeting you.
Same
Thank
here,
you.
and thank you for the work that you do, Mona. I'm really,
Thank
really
you.
impressed.
Thank
Okay.
you.